past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
On this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about a topic that will probably strike very close to home for many of you, depending on who you are and what you sort of feel like your place is in the United States in the year 2020. The title of the book is White Christian Privilege: The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. It is the contention of the author of this book, Kiati Joshi, that we in America have what she characterizes as an optical illusion in which we say that we have, and many of us sincerely believe that we have, complete religious equality and freedom in this country. And she wants to make the point that this is, in fact, not really the case, or certainly not to the extent that some of us might blithely assume, and especially those of us who happen to be white and Christian, because there is something deeply embedded in the fabric of our country and in many of the ways in which we interact with each other, many of the ways in which our civic functions and operations are constructed that really adhere to a Christian norm. And what we often don't stop to think about, if we are within that Christian norm, we don't often stop to think about what it feels like to be an American, but from a different religious background, or perhaps no religious background whatsoever. And of course, the effect, among other things, is rendering one to feel like an outsider in your own country. The author explores all of this and much more in her fascinating book, which I have in front of me. And it's published by New York University Press, again titled White Christian Privilege: The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. The author, Kiati Joshi, is professor of education at Farley Dickinson University. Professor Joshi, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
I appreciate this opportunity very much. I want to say, first of all, and I don't very seldom bring in the personal perspective into interviews like this quite as boldly as I'm going to right now, but I want to confess to you that there were plenty of moments when I was deeply uncomfortable as I read your book, and I think it's perhaps because, or in large part because, I happen to be white, I happen to be Christian, my faith is important to me, and I am reading a book that summons me to look at my own faith and the place of white Christianity, so to speak, in American life in ways that I have never never done before. And you acknowledge actually at one point in the book that to make headway on these deep, vexing, and complicated issues, one has to go into uncomfortable places. Tell us more about what you thought about in this respect as you wrote this book. And did you think very much about how you could frame your arguments in a way that in which the typical Christian reader would be receptive to what you have to say?
Yeah, and let me first say that I very much appreciate you saying and, you know, being upfront with your listeners that you were uncomfortable reading parts of the book. That's going to happen if we're actually going to take on some of these issues that we've been pushing to the side. And it's because we've been pushing issues, you know, racial issues, religious issues to the side, that we are kind of in the state that we're in as a nation today. I very much kept in mind that white Christian readers reading this book, and Christians who are racial minorities even reading this book, would be uncomfortable with it. And I was out to get my message across, but in a way that it could be heard. As someone who does workshops, and I've been doing public presentations on these topics for over a decade, I'd had some practice, you know, talking about this and getting my points across in a way that can be heard. So again, I truly appreciate your honesty, you know, in being uncomfortable.
I remember at one point in the book, you talk about discussing many of these issues and questions in your own university classroom where you teach, and how at certain points in the semester, you will ask your students, how are you feeling right now? Or how do you feel? Or how does this make you feel what we're talking about today? And it was kind of interesting to read those words, because you realize that most of us who are part of the world of higher education tend not to ask that particular question. But I can see how when we're talking about these kind of issues, it makes all the sense in the world to ask how a student is feeling.
Yeah, and you know, the book provides a couple of chapters on history and law, you know, in terms of showing exactly how whiteness and Christianity, Protestant Christianity for most of United States history, has been embedded in our public policy, in federal legislation, in court decisions, Supreme Court decisions, so on. And the thing is that we, even when we're learning history and law, these are not emotionally neutral topics. We teach Brown versus Board, or we teach Plessy versus Ferguson, some of the Supreme Court cases that are more well-known than others. Some people, white folks, can be embarrassed. Black folks are like, here we go again. You know, can we not bring this up? Or here we are bringing it up. Others can feel like, how come this is so important and I really didn't understand it? So we're having reactions to that material. And we have to start understanding that those reactions are there, because it affects how we take in material. And that's one of the reasons I will always ask at least every other week, if not more, how students are feeling upon receiving the material.
So in other words, it's not just that you're curious or that you want to kind of go into kind of juicy, smushy, you know, personal territory with your students. As an educator, it's important for you to know how they feel on a very visceral level. And if their hackles are being raised, or if old wounds are being reopened, or whatever the case may be, you're probably not doing your job as effectively as you could if you're trying to keep the personal level of all of this out of the equation. It just
can't
be avoided.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And so educators and folks out there need to understand that these are not value neutral, emotionally neutral topics.
I want to make sure that our listeners understand who you are in terms of your own background. I mean, where you are from, where you grew up, and what it felt like to grow up where you grew up. And I'm also really anxious to give you a chance as well to talk about, in a sense, your relationship with the Christian faith now as an adult woman. But let's begin with your own childhood. Tell our listeners about where you were born and where you grew up and what that childhood was like and why.
Sure. So I am an Indian American Hindu. I was born in Ahmedabad, India, and immigrated to this country with my parents many moons ago when I was a year and a half old. My father was part of the wave of Asian doctors who came to the United States because of the Immigration Act of 1965. And I'm Hindu. I've grown up Hindu. My family, probably when we moved to Atlanta in 1975, and I'm a proud Atlantan, I will say, when we moved to Atlanta in 1975, I would surmise that we are probably one of the first, we were probably one of the first 15 Indian families to settle in Atlanta, Georgia. Growing up, people kind of didn't know what to make of a little brown Hindu girl. I wasn't black. I wasn't white. And then when I said I was Hindu, or my family said we were Hindu, it was kind of like, what's that, right? On a very serious level, I faced a tremendous amount of bullying and harassment growing up. I was made fun of by classmates. I would go home to India many summers, and my classmates asked me if I had my own pet elephant, or you know, what was my mud hut like. And I think what was really terrible was that most of the time my teachers didn't intervene. And I think you can draw a straight line from what I experienced in middle school and high school to the work I've been doing for the last 20 years, which is anti-bias, social justice education, anti-bias trainings with our teachers, administrators, but I also work with judges and lawyers, trying to make sure that we can create a better world so that students aren't harassed and people aren't harassed the way that I was. I was always, Greg, I was always proud to be Indian American and Hindu, just not at school, because I grew up with a strong community. And I would, gosh, I think I would have done anything not to have my brown skin. I ended up studying religion. I never read any book in high school. I didn't like English class. But the one book I read was Night by Elie Wiesel. And that started my absolute fascination with the Holocaust. I went on to Emory University and got my undergraduate degree and my master's there, first in religion, then in theological studies. I focused on, and I took as many classes as I could on Holocaust, genocide, and all. And that ultimately took me for 1 year study to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And then I came back to the United States to start and finish a doctoral program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in social justice education. I for the last 17 years, I consider myself to be part of the Episcopal Church community, as I am in an interfaith, interracial family. My husband is a white Christian man. And so, you know, I consider myself part of the Hindu community and part of the Episcopal community. This book I've written has personal stories. It also has history and law. And the book is intended to help us build a more perfect union. I am not interested in blaming anyone. I certainly am not maligning the church, but I really want folks to understand Christianity's role in the construction of whiteness and white supremacy.
Could I just ask briefly, before we really dig into the book itself, something about your husband's reaction to this book and whether or not he was in a sense, a valuable collaborator with you as you crafted it, or would that have complicated things still further to involve him in that way?
Oh, no, absolutely not. He absolutely, probably knows the book as well as I do in terms of the conversations. And, you know, we have built an interfaith life. And so the one story I can share that would give you some insight as to what this means for us and how he's been a conversation partner in the writing of this book is that he's an elected official here in New Jersey. He's a freeholder at the LIP, which is like a county commissioner in other states. And so local, you know, communities know him and invite him to things. Well, Greg, one year in November, the local Hindu temple, one of our temples here, was having their annual Diwali dinner. And they had reached out to John because they have a relationship with him. They have a relationship with me, but they have a relationship with him. They reached out to him. He said, sure, I'll come to the Diwali dinner. It happened to be the same night as our feast for thanks and giving at our church, which I had agreed to being a part of. So that particular Sunday evening, he went as the Christian went to the Hindu temple for the Diwali celebration, and I, the Hindu, went to church as part of our celebration for Thanksgiving that we were doing.
So maybe there's hope for us yet.
There you go. There you go.
Speaking of hope for us yet, I also want to give you a chance to just touch on another personal story that is in the book that I think is also really important because you could certainly have written this book in a sense more isolated within your own tradition and you don't do that. And the story I'm thinking about involves your own father and a woman named Vicky who worked with him, who was a Christian, and not only a Christian, but a Baptist. So certainly I'm assuming over to the kind of the more conservative wing of the Christian church, which is a broad and complicated animal in and of itself. But tell our listeners about your father and this woman who worked for him for many years, and in a sense, why that story is included in the book.
Well, my father had an office manager named Vicky, and she was a Southern Baptist woman. And when she first started working for my dad, her church congregation, members of the church congregation, gave her a hard time for working for my dad. And it kind of, you know, came out. He wasn't Christian. He's this dark-skinned man. I mean, people didn't understand what Hindu was. He was essentially a heathen in their eyes, you know, and she defended my dad. You know, he's a good man. And she worked for him in the end for almost 30 years. And actually, soon after this started happening, maybe a couple of years later, I don't know exactly, the church got a new minister. And in the end, the minister's wife ended up working for my father also, you know. So the book highlights stories that relate to Judaism, that relate to Native American spirituality, that relate to Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus, because, if you will, the common denominator in all of this is white Christian privilege, really, which is how, you know, which has affected the construction of our society. But that story was illuminating because it wasn't just the fact that my dad is a racial minority or a religious minority. It's that he was both, and he wasn't white and Christian, which was affecting how people were seeing Vicky working for this person.
Right. And part of the whole point of your book is that even when we can look at gratifying stories like that one. I mean, a story that begins decades ago. I mean, it says a lot about your dad and about Vicky, that they had this wonderful relationship and that she boldly stood up for your dad and continued to work for him. I mean, it's really gratifying and inspiring to hear that kind of story. But it is easy to hear a story like that and then jump to blithe assumptions that this is America in every corner of our country. And that, in fact, is not the case. And even where there is not sort of overt and rather outrageous prejudice and bias and racism being demonstrated, we still need to look for kind of an implicit ground level privilege among white Christians that is, in a sense, very easy to miss, especially if one is a white Christian.
Right. That's right. That's right. And you know, and that's the thing about privilege, is that if you have it, it's often invisible to you. And the whole goal of this book is to make the invisible visible, which actually also helps racial and religious minorities. I mean, there were things I experienced growing up that weren't discrimination, but it's just that the other person had an advantage because they knew what was going on. And a kind of a quote unquote small example I can give you, and I put small in quotes because when every day these happen, they accumulate and really impact you. Any one maybe isn't gonna, you know, affect you so much. But the one I can share with you is I was in English class in high school, and we were learning simile and metaphor. And my teacher said, okay, well, you know, simile, metaphor, la, 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 you know, like the Good Samaritan story, and goes on. I didn't know what the Good Samaritan story was. But I also sensed that I was supposed to know what it was, and I dare not ask what it is. But as a Hindu, where would I have learned the Good Samaritan story, right? But that's just kind of accepted in everyday conversation that people know what that is.
Right. It's when you live in a world in which to be Christian is the norm, and to be not a Christian, to be something else or nothing at all, religiously speaking, that is a very difficult scenario within which to fully function and participate, and especially for a youngster. You also tell a story of a young man, and I don't remember, you don't really explicitly say that this was a friend of yours, but a young man who I think was originally from India and I believe was Hindu, but a very good soccer player, but who had a coach who was doing something with the team that this young man simply could not accept. I think this is a interesting example of the same sort of thing in a little more serious level.
Yes, absolutely. This young man was growing up in North Carolina, and he was part of the soccer team. And the coach always started, you know, with the Lord's Prayer. And he finally said he wasn't going to participate in the huddle to say the Lord's Prayer. And ultimately, he was benched. He never got to start the games because the coach accused him of breaking up team spirit and, you know, working against team camaraderie. The coach didn't see that this is a Christian prayer at a public school, you know. The same student also experienced a similar issue. He was a member of the National Honor Society, and they met at a different church every month or so. So he suggested to his faculty sponsor, hey, let's meet at, you know, at the Hindu temple where his family would go. And the faculty sponsor said, no, we're not going to do that. So he was kind of like, what is going on? And he kind of stopped going to things. And in National Honor Society, you have to attend an X percentage of events. Otherwise, you're kicked out. So guess what? He was kicked out. And he graduated at the top of his class, but he was not able to wear the NHS stole that the other students were wearing on graduation day. So there are real life consequences to the presence of white Christian privilege vis-a-vis the lives of racial and religious minorities.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kiati Joshi about her new book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. It is her contention in this fascinating book that many of us are operating under a misassumption, an optical illusion of sorts, that there is, in fact, a more sort of perfect and pervasive freedom of religion and equality between religious faiths in the United States than, in fact, there is. Professor Joshi, I think it's really important at this point that we shift into the more subtle, because I think a whole lot of people listening would agree that, for instance, the story of this young man, a Hindu, being forced to recite the Lord's Prayer with his soccer teammates, I'm sure someone listening might not see it as an outrage, but I think a lot of people would. I mean, that seems like a very overt example of what you're talking about. But I think it's fair to say that much of your book is about this layer of Christian white privilege on a much more subtle level that the typical person might not be aware of at all. Why don't you spell out what you think are a couple of the most important examples of how this white Christian privilege plays out in a way that so many of us tend to completely miss?
So, Greg, I think even right there, we could look at even the use of the word subtle, because I think for some, you're absolutely right. You know, I'll talk about it in a minute or two, and somebody's going to be like, wow, that's subtle. And yet for those of us who encounter it, it's actually not so subtle.
Oh, right. You know? It doesn't feel like a minor matter to be, in a sense, the victim of this, or, you know, to be on the outside looking in. Right.
Right.
I'm very much
right.
Speaking from the perspective of, in a sense, the insider, that
right.
These are things we tend to miss, and we don't miss them because they're inconsequential, but
right.
We just miss them because we miss them.
Right. Well, so one example is think about the image of prayer. You know, especially like when prayer is depicted on television, what comes to mind? Usually what comes to mind is somebody, and what's considered the normal way of praying, is someone sitting in a church, hands, you know, together, sitting quietly in a pew. That's not how it always prayer looks in a black church, and that's not certainly how prayer looks necessarily at a Hindu temple. At a Hindu temple, I'm sitting on the floor, legs crossed, you know, bowing my head, or in some cases, people are prostrating themselves onto the floor in front of the deities. But what gets identified as kind of the normal way of praying? That's one example I can give you.
Another can I just jump in?
Sure.
Sorry. I just wanted to say one of the most interesting examples you gave as you kind of talked about this is that even when somebody makes a special point of trying to craft a prayer that is, let's say, religiously neutral, that if for some public event, and they might go out of their way with the best of intentions to, for instance, not mention Jesus or dear Heavenly Father. I mean, anything that would brand that prayer as specifically Christian. But even when those very specific and overt Christian names are left out of the prayer, what remains is still, to someone not part of that tradition, essentially a Christian prayer, but with the name of Jesus taken out of it. That really does not go far enough to address what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that's where it's really helpful to, if you have an interfaith association, or like we have here locally, an interfaith clergy association, you know, when you can have diverse representation, then a conversation can be had that what's a prayer that can sound like it is as inclusive and encompassing as we can make it. Of course, that's still going to be an issue for those who are agnostic and atheist, and we must recognize that. But I think there are steps that places have taken. In the book, I talk about the Interfaith Association in Lynchburg, Virginia, which may surprise people, but they've done it to make sure that you have a prayer that really can reach as many people as possible. Another way it comes up is think about folks who run for office. Those who are not Christian often face questions that Christians don't. And we can take the example, in the book I talk about Nikki Haley and Bobby Jindal, both who grew up as part of Indian American families. Nikki Haley grew up Sikh American, and Bobby Jindal's family is Hindu. And, you know, both of them were questioned. Indeed, Nikki Haley's campaign received lots of questions via email, almost saying, well, what religion is she? You know, if she's not Christian, I'm not sure she can represent me, right? So that subtext is often there when you have non-white Christians running for office. Indeed, both of them have converted to Christianity, and that's a point of information. I'm not making judgment there. It's just interesting to note that fact.
You also talk in your book about how things like the construction of the calendar, for instance, for a school, has a whole lot to do with this assumption that's often kind of, in a sense, tacitly made that we're a Christian country, generally speaking. Most of us are Christian, and so being Christian is the normal thing, and so let's construct our calendar accordingly and then try to make special accommodations for those that fall outside of that purview. And you say just the fact that you've started from that first assumption where you end up having to make special accommodations, that right there is a clear demonstration of, in a sense, the central premise of your book, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, there was a few things that you mentioned that we can kind of pick apart a little bit. Sometimes, whether it's in my classes or when I walk into a school, you know, people will be like, okay, well, we really don't want to deal with religion. We can't do that. And my first reaction is that, first of all, religion is in your schools, specifically Christianity. And we can go with just the example you brought up of the calendar. Our schools, our society, they're not religion neutral. They're not race neutral. The starting point is a white Christianity, and we have to be able to recognize that. Now, school districts, workplaces are making accommodations, but that right there tells you that when we make an accommodation, there is something that's already the standard, if you will, the white Christian norm, and then we're making that. And so what does that look like? You know, my parents used to keep me home on Diwali, which is a huge Hindu holiday. You know, as a child, that's how you know it's a really important holiday when you don't have to go to school. But there have been people who have said, you know what, I don't want to stay home because it's twice as more work for me. I'd rather just go to school. So what are the consequences, you know, when that's the situation and people decide I'll just go to work or I'll just go to school? That affects how they see their religion. That affects family relationships and so on and so on.
One of the distinctions that you make at one point that helps us understand this on a level that I had not really stopped to think about is that there is in many cases a distinction between religious practice and religious belief, or a distinction between religious belief and religious action. And if you are starting from a perspective in which one is much more important than the other, then almost certainly you are not going to have sufficient understanding and appreciation and sensitivity for another religious tradition in which that balance is a little bit different. Can you explain to our listeners what I'm talking about?
Yes. So if we take the idea of belief versus action, we can see that there are certain things that are not part of Protestant faiths that are part of the Jewish faith or the Sikh faith or the Muslim faith, for example, like head covering, that become an issue. So in Protestant faith, there's nothing that says you have to cover your head. Some people choose to do it out of their own personal reverence. But in Sikhism, observant Sikhs, men will wear turbans. Jewish men will wear a kippah. Those have not been always accepted, for example, in the United States military, and exceptions and accommodations had to be made. If the idea of a head covering had been part of Protestant Christian faiths, Sikhs and Jews probably would have had an easier time than they've had. Another example of belief and action is the issue of Native Americans and land. You know, and it's more about belief. The land is sacred for Native Americans, actually for others also. As a Hindu, land is sacred. And, you know, we would not really bulldoze we wouldn't be okay with bulldozing a cemetery to build something. But land that has been considered sacred by a particular tribe or nation, a Native American nation, isn't always recognized as such. And pipelines have been built. Indeed, walls have been built or are being built. And if the idea of land had been sacred in Protestant faiths, I think we would have a much better understanding of why that is. And we would consider it sacred and not bulldoze and build walls.
By the way, some of what you were just now talking about reminds me of a point in the book when you explain the concept of facially neutral laws, which I, if I remember correctly, is something that you mention about certain laws that are created, and they're not created to specifically, you know, make life difficult for any particular person. They, a law that was not conceived consciously to be any kind of a persecution or meant to dishonor a particular faith, but because it applies to everybody, then you can think of it as facially neutral. But you go on to say Christians never experience a facially neutral ban on their practices by their very nature, because those laws so often proceed from an assumption that that's just kind of normal life.
Right, because the people making them are coming from that viewpoint and from that particular spiritual perspective. So it can seem neutral, head coverings wasn't an issue until observant Jews came along wanting to serve in the military, until Sikhs wanted to serve in the military. And then what can happen is somebody can say, well, we need to remain neutral, but it's not neutral. You've privileged Protestant faiths. It's just because they don't have any issue of head covering, it's seen as you're making an accommodation here.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Kyati Joshi about her book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Before we get to some important changes that you would suggest, and we will need to leave it to our listeners to explore those more thoroughly in reading your book themselves, I do want to make sure that I give you an opportunity to respond to those Christians who at the moment feel very much under fire, who feel like their cherished reality, life as they have known it all their lives, is being wrenched away from them. This is something that you touch on time and time again in your book. Given that the demographics are shifting, that in fact the numbers tell us that that the number of white Christians in this country is diminishing. Nevertheless, you say that white Christians should not be as fearful as they tend to be when these kind of questions and concerns are raised. Why not?
Well, first of all, I think that white Christian folks who are feeling that way and who would be open would, by reading my book, they'll understand and have a better understanding of just how embedded Christianity is in our societal and legal structures, number one. And the second thing is that we hear these, you know, the Pew Research Forum will put out statistics, and certainly we'll hear, we've been getting updates from the American Community Survey, which then falls back on the census, as to the white population declining. And the truth of the matter is that even with a white Christian American population declining, the power of white Christianity is not going to dissipate overnight, because it's been embedded in our societal and legal structures. Now, having said this, I want to acknowledge that those who are very spiritual, and you know, there's no question that on a certain level, Christianity and spirituality is not taken seriously in certain parts of our country. I know, for example, in higher education, you know, to be religious, people question you. And so I want to acknowledge that. And certain Christians have faced bias, but the truth is, at a societal level and an institutional level, white Christianity has a tremendous amount of power in the way it has historically and continues to in the way our country has our society is formed.
And you don't see that going away anytime soon. Although, of course, right. Part of what your book is hoping, is arguing, is that there are ways in which that white Christian privilege can be lessened, supplanted, shifted in some ways, so that we are living in a country that is truly fair to everybody of all faiths. Briefly, you make a distinction in your book between pluralism as being the approach. Let's let everybody be here of whatever faith, and versus a social justice approach that begins in a sense with a more complicated starting point. Tell us about that difference.
Yeah. So pluralism recognizes that we have a tremendous amount of religious diversity. It looks at religious diversity, and we certainly do. But the presence of religious diversity doesn't mean that actually everybody has freedom of religion. Taking a social justice approach means looking at the fact that we have this religious diversity, but some don't want it. Some religions are not allowed to practice as freely as others, and takes into account essentially white Christian privilege, so that we actually can fulfill the promise of this nation and we can, in fact, build a more perfect union.
One of the ways that you address this possibility is by laying out what you see as five elements that might be part of a social justice approach to religious equality. And they involve five changes: change the language, change the questions, change the focus, change foundational assumptions, and change the paradigm. Briefly, I'm afraid I would love to have you at least on a surface level touch on each of these potential changes.
Oh, sure. So change the language can mean many things, but on a very everyday level, instead of asking someone, oh, where is your church? Or what's your Christmas? Which are very Christian-centric questions, you know, where do you pray if somewhere? Or what are the holidays in your religion would be a better way to go about it. Change the questions. Sometimes you will read newspaper headlines. You know, should we allow the ban of pork in jails? You know, or should we allow Sikhs to serve in the military? And we've got to change that question, because right there, that's setting up the norm of Christianity. So instead, you know, how do we make meals more inclusive for everyone would be one way to go. Change the focus would be making sure that religion is taken into account. So for example, National Geographic issued an apology a couple of years ago for the racist coverage they'd had for almost a century. And I was very happy to see that, but actually it's been very colonized Christian coverage also. They depicted rituals, indigenous rituals around the world in kind of backward, uncivilized ways. So change the focus a little bit. Changing the foundational assumption. Greg, this is a really important one. We have to understand we are not all the same, that we are different, and we're going to have to understand those differences in order to make some serious progress. And then change the paradigm. I'll end with, it might surprise listeners to know that I advocate the saying of Merry Christmas over Happy Holidays. We need to say Merry Christmas. I, in my heart, completely understand why Christians would be offended by that or feel like their religious holiday is being watered down. And I am with you. I ask that if we're going to say Merry Christmas, we also say Happy Diwali and Eid Mubarak and Hag Sameach to our friends celebrating and recognizing Passover. So that's a fundamental change of paradigm. And so I outline these, but I really hope to hear from your listeners and readers of the book on how they see these five elements in their neighborhoods and communities. And I hope to hear from them.
And I want to say too that I said this once in the interview, that the Christian faith is a very complicated thing in and of itself. And it is all along the political spectrum from the far left to the far right. But I think the central premise of your book is really something that really any white Christian on that entire political spectrum would still benefit from reading, because even someone to the farthest progressive extreme might not understand some of the embedded white Christian privilege that is still part of our society.
Well, I'm glad that you feel that way, and I hope many others will also.
The book, again, is titled White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America, published by New York University Press, and the author, Kiati Joshi. Professor Joshi, I really appreciate this opportunity to delve further into your fascinating book. I hope many people will seek it out, and I thank you again for being part of today's morning show. It was great to talk with you.
It was great talking with you, and thank you for taking the interest you've taken in the book and the subject matter.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, in his monthly visit to the program. And joining him will be Dr. Eric Gallian, who is the superintendent of the Racine Unified School District, and will also be joined by John Delagrave, who is the Racine County Executive. And we'll be talking about how the county and the school district specifically are going to be trying to contend with COVID-19 as we move into the fall. On Thursday, a look at one of the most legendary tennis players of the 20th century, Alice Marble. On Friday, it is Nan Calvert and her monthly visit to the program, and she'll be speaking with a world-renowned expert on one of the most amazing of all creatures, the dragonfly. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. A reminder that the Morning Show is available to you 7 days a week as a podcast, available on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. It's important that you search for the program, though, under its proper name. Look for the podcast version under The Morning Show with Greg.